Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and happy Thanksgiving. Team All of It is off for the day, so we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations from this past couple of months. The one thing these guests have in common is that they've all written recent memoirs, exploring issues around family, gender, sexuality, the culture of gun ownership, heartbreak, and believe it or not, squirrels. We begin with life, love, and the decades-long acting career of the great Sally Field. Her memoir, In Pieces, was published this fall. Let's take a listen to our conversation. Congratulations on your book.
Well, congratulations on your show.
Oh, thank you so much. 7 years to write a book. Yeah. I wrote a book and it took me 7 years too, so maybe that's a magic number. Was it in fits and starts? Did you start it, put it away, come back to it?
No, I pretty much was obsessed with it the whole time, but I think probably the good news is that I have a day job, so I'd be torn away to work, to do something else, and or to promote what I had done, promote a film, you know, go on stage, something. And always when that happened, I was slightly resentful that I was being torn away because I wanted to get back to it. But every time I did leave for a period of time, I'd come back to it and go, oh, did I write that? Oh, my God.
Also, you get that sense of you change over time.
Yeah.
And as you go back and read what you've written, it may feel or seem a little bit different.
Well, it certainly felt different because I'd been away from it. So I hadn't remembered it as you know, like I had done it just that morning. And it gave me some distance to see what I was doing and hear the story sort of new, to know if I was telling a story. So I think that helped. If I were an experienced writer, if my job had been over the last 53 years of my life instead of acting been this, I think I would have another way of you know, I'd have different miles in the saddle, so mm-hmm. I would have a way of hearing it without walking away for 3 months, you know.
You tell the story chronologically, so I'd like mm-hmm. to sort of construct the interview that way, mm-hmm. if it's okay. In this book, your mother is a constant presence in your life. You write, her ability to look for that little bit of sunshine in a situation that seemed pitch black always gave me the sense that if everything went out, I had a backup generator. My mother. As you wrote this book, what did you learn about your mom that maybe you hadn't realized before when you were in the thick of being a daughter?
Well, the reason I wrote the book, I really didn't have any intention of writing anything that would be published. I really wrote it for myself because when my mother passed away, I felt so terribly disquieted. I had done all the things that you hear you should do. I'd had all those dialogues and dotted the T's and crossed the I's and did everything that I was supposed to do, I thought. And yet I felt anything but at peace. I felt like that there was some festering wound on me that I had to find, or I was in danger. And I didn't know how to do that except to try to learn a new craft, because it was in the craft of acting that I really learned about myself in ways that I would not have done had I not had to do it, because I wanted to be an actor and I wanted to find moments in a character outside of myself. So I had to dig into myself. Mm-hmm. I had to know things that I didn't want to know. And so I realized that it was in writing it in that kind of serious note of intention that would force me to go into the boxes that I didn't want to go into, read the letters I didn't want to look at, that I'd saved all my life, to really understand my mother. There was something I needed to know that I didn't know without doing it, because I had avoided knowing my entire life, and I had to find out.
Did you find those answers?
I think I did. It was... And all the way through the writing of it, you'll hear me question why I'm doing this, and please let me find something different, and begging the gods that be, or really my haunting or non-haunting mother, that she wasn't around me, that she had promised she'd haunt me, but that I felt she wasn't anywhere near me. And so I didn't know what I would find, but I think at the end of it, and throughout, it surprised me. I'm surprised by what I avoided seeing, mm-hmm. and what I discover about all of the members of my family, about myself, about my own road, and how I traveled it. So yes, I met her at the end.
Do you think you were avoiding those things out of self-preservation?
Yes.
When you were living them?
Yes. I think I still have a survival technique of putting my head in the sand, and I really like it in that sand. That sand is just, it's hard to breathe.
It's a little warm,
but you know,
it's cozy.
It's kind of warm and yeah, close and it, but it's muted. Everything is really, you can hear vibration, but you can't hear any words. And I had my kind of survival technique was in not looking at anything that part of me would send me information to say, you can't handle this, mm-hmm. don't look at this. And that voice, that piece of me, really dictated what I would look at and know and what I wouldn't know.
You talk about that inner voice, and it was a part of the book that really, it's a short passage. A lot of people know who've read about your book so far really understand that you're open about having experienced abuse, verbal and sexual, at the hands of your stepfather. Mm-hmm. But there's a part in the book when you finally rear up and yell at him,
mm-hmm.
and you realize he's frightened.
Yeah.
And it was that moment of finding your voice. Can you remember that moment and what it felt like at that moment?
Oh, yes. It's one of the most vivid memories of my life. And it wasn't my voice that I found, because it took me so long to put all the pieces of me together. But it was a piece of me, an aspect of myself that had stayed hidden from me. I didn't know it existed. I didn't know I had that rage. I didn't see it. I was completely blindsided by it. And when it emerged with such an eruption that I didn't exist. The rest of me wasn't there. Mm-hmm. All that I was this absolute white, burning red, white, red first, then it turned white, the fire, rage. And something in me didn't care anymore whether I lived or died, or more importantly, whether I was loved. Hmm. It didn't matter. And he reacted as he reacted, which was pretty mind-boggling. I only knew in going back through an acting exercise in writing this, you know, really trying to relive that moment and see so vividly the room and the smell of it and see every detail of it, that I remembered what he looked like and how it struck me. And that's what I write about.
What was that acting exercise? Do you remember?
Well, I used a lot of acting exercises, actually, to write this.
Oh, interesting.
You know, various ones from, you know, emotional memory or room exercise. There's an exercise very provocative called room exercise. All of them really sort of meditative states, you know, meditating before you write. And then just going and not necessarily dictating to yourself what you're going to write or where you're going to go. It just comes flying out. But I try to, since I am not familiar with the craft of acting, I am with acting and not with writing, I tried to use the craft that I do know to help me in the craft that I don't know. So I was trying to employ a lot of those tools.
We're speaking with Sally Field about her new memoir, In Pieces. You talk about your career, obviously, a lot, and your feelings about what you were doing at the time, Gidget was your big break. That was for about a year. And then The Flying Nun. For Gidget, you learned to surf, right? And Flying Nun, they strapped you in and propelled you across sound stages. When you think back on that, now that you are an experienced actress and a woman who's lived a life, what would you tell young Sally about each of those jobs?
Well, I know a lot of things, a lot of different things, but as far as the flying and the surfing is concerned, I would really tell myself to question them of, really, is this really the best idea? You know, it's one thing to do the, you know, the easy and close stuff, but first of all, I was never a surfer. I was never going to be a surfer, and to put me out there on one of the huge, enormous, very heavy boards that were used in, you know, 1964 and 65. Mm-hmm. It was kind of ludicrous. And what if, you know, just a fluke thing and the board hit me in the head and then, well, that was the end of the show.
Right.
So, and luckily, halfway through the first year of The Nun, they realized, you know, maybe we shouldn't use Sally for the long shots, because they couldn't see if it was me anyway. Mm-hmm. They were so far away. And also, I think it was because one day when the special effects man was testing the wires, they were called piano wires, which everybody could see them. They had to paint them out usually, but they used to call them piano wires, which I really doubt that they were used on anybody's piano, because music we weren't making. But when one day one of them broke, when they just testing them, like, okay, they went, gosh, guys, you know what? Maybe we ought to get a stunt person for this. And they did. They got a wonderful woman who stayed for all 3 years. And she was much better than I was anyway, for goodness sakes. I looked like all caved over. I couldn't hold myself out flat. It was not a good idea.
Well, you make no bones about it in the book that you really didn't like that job. You really weren't happy with it, and you had so much bigger aspirations for yourself as an artist. So when it ended, did you feel relieved, like, gosh, I don't do this more, or scared about what's next?
You know, the evolution of finding even my dreams, were so slow to come to me. When The Nun was finished, I had by then, how old was he? You know, like a 6 months old son. I was married. My life was totally emerging, and I wasn't sad at all. I guess I was relieved, but I think part of me felt a responsibility that I had let them down, because I had done everything they asked, except I stopped doing publicity after a while, because for goodness sakes, I was pregnant the whole last year, and I, you know, really didn't want that to be the topic of everybody's conversation, and that would have been the topic of everybody's conversation.
The pregnant nun.
Yeah. It just was a sight gag, if there ever was one. I was a sight gag before that. So I just felt, okay, here we go. Buckle up. And I felt an emergence of something that I didn't know what.
We're speaking with Sally Field about her new memoir, In Pieces. We'll continue the conversation after this quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back. Let's take a listen to part two of our rebroadcast of my conversation with Sally Field about her memoir, In Pieces. Take a listen. You trained with Lee Strasberg.
Yes.
And he was extremely influential
in
your life. You kind of write almost that he saved you professionally in some ways. What did he give you that you were missing?
Well, it was right in the middle of, not even in the middle, it was the very end of the first year of The Flying Nun, when I felt, and so much was going on as a young person, so much in myself was emerging and didn't know where to put it, and because I was, 1920, and, so much of me was bubbling up that was confusing, and maybe I would have been in turmoil regardless of where I was. But there I was, dressed as a nun in the mid-60s, when the rest of the world was not, to say the least. And I felt just disgraced because I was such a joke. The show was, and I couldn't tell the difference between me and the show. So Lee really, not in a very quiet way, really, not in a demonstrative way. I did a scene for him at the Actors Studio. I had been attending the Actors Studio as an invited guest, kind of, but doing the exercise class before he was there. And at that time, Lee would come to the L.A. Actors Studio 6 months out of the year. He would spend the winter months here mm-hmm. in New York and then the summer months in Los Angeles. And everyone would fight to get on the sign-up list to do a scene in front of him. And I had signed up during my hiatus to do a scene, and I realized it was like just days practically before I was going to go back into the second season. And I did a scene, and which was from Sartre's Respectful Prostitute. So
you have a sense of humor.
Something. He reached out to me in a way, you know, with his eagle eye, that he had spotted something. And I felt it, and I hung on to it, and it fueled me. And when I could then get back, because then I would go to work and I would be drawn away, but soon I would start working with him at his institute when the nun wasn't going. Where it was much more in depth, three times a week, I believe, then. Mm-hmm. So it was really intensive. And he was hugely influential in teaching us all kind of techniques that were very hard to understand how you use, actually. How do you apply this? But nonetheless, even if you walk away from it and dropped it all, it affected you greatly, until ultimately he and I had a huge fight that also really affected me greatly.
At one point, he cautioned you to take care of the emotional part of your brain, to guard it.
Mm-hmm.
Was that good advice?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was. And I hear his words in my head to this day when I'm working. Hmm. Little things he would say. There's another man that I worked with later, Marty Ritt, who was from the Actors Studio, but their language about acting and the craft stay in my head. Certainly, Lee's right about that, and he always was right about that, and I have to guard against it. And also, you know, there'll be a... ultimately, he hammered me for it because it would create a kind of facileness that you is no good, is dull,
mm-hmm.
And lacks depth. But that's hard to understand unless you really fall into that pit.
I'm curious about when you were a young mother and an actress in Hollywood. Now today, people get nurseries on the set and get their au pairs paid for by the studios. You were a working mom with little kids at a time when that didn't happen. Was that a struggle for you? And how did your peers treat you as mom on the set, even though you're the star of the show, but you're a working mom?
Well, luckily, I didn't have my first son until the last show, really. Mm-hmm. I was pregnant for the last season, the third year of The Flying Nun. Then we had a bit of a break. I had a bit of a break to have him, and then we went back and finished the last five shows or whatever it was. So when I was at first a young working mother with a very young child, it wasn't for a long time. And then I was a struggling actor trying to find work. It's an extremely hard thing to do, especially in show business. You get taken away to another state, and I didn't have the money to bring my kids with me, even if it would have been a good idea, which probably wouldn't have been when they were in school and things. So it was really, really hard on me. I think it was less hard on them. I'm still apologizing to them, and they're like, "Oh, get over it. No one wanted you there. Come on." You know, even though I don't think that's true, I think that it's very hard to do. Every mother knows that you have your child, and they even and you go to work every day. Even if you don't leave and go to another state, you go to work every day, and there'll be the days when they go, "Don't leave me, don't leave me," and you have to say, I have to go. I'm turning now. I'm leaving. I'm walking out the door." And part of you is just dying, and like you're like there's a you know a leg is being torn off, but then you're out an hour later, 2 hours later. You're free. Oh my gosh! I have a life. I'm a person. I'm not just that. I'm alive. And part of you hate to say it. You hate to admit it. But gee, it feels good out here doing what I do. And then you go back and go, "Oh my God! If I missed you, I can never do that again. I'm never leaving. I think I have to quit my job." And then you, so it's a real, constant, complicated tear.
A push and a pull.
Mm-hmm.
I always, that overnight trip in the hotel, it's like, oh, I get to,
yeah, exactly.
I get to wake up in the bed by myself tomorrow.
Wait a minute, this is not all bad.
I have a very strong memory of you and Norma Rae. And I remember feeling like that's a strong woman and being really drawn to the strength in that character. When you first read for the part, got the part, what was it that drew you to her? And did you have that sense that there would be young women watching this character?
No, and no to all of that. First of all, it was the first role. Marty Ritt called me in to meet with me. And up to that point in my career, pretty much, the roles that were of great value to me, I'd had to work so hard to get. Marty said that this film had been offered to five or six other actresses that were much more important than I was, that the studio wanted, but they had all, for some reason, turned it down. And he said, "I think that they would have all been wonderful, but things work out as they should, and I want you for this." And, of course, I was, of course, thrilled. He said, "But the studio doesn't want you, not at all. But I'm going to fight with them, and I'm going to win." And at that point, I hadn't even read it, because I had been working on another film, just sort of playing the girl, just trying to hang on, in Alabama. And I had flown back to L.A. that morning. But in those days, there was no way to get you the script. They couldn't. You know,
email it to you.
They couldn't email it to you. You couldn't. They didn't have overnight. Yeah. You know, you were just. It was a different world. So it was waiting for me at my house. It had been messengered to my house, and
that was
Los Angeles.
A big deal at the time.
That was a big deal. It's like, you know, but I hadn't read it. So, but my mother had, because she was there with my boys, taking care of them while I was in Alabama working. And she, as I ran around my bedroom trying to figure out, what do I wear? Who is this person? Tell me about this. What is this? And she would try to tell me what it was that she read, and I didn't understand. I got a little bit of it and just decided I better dress all in beige because I didn't know who I was. But Marty said, "Read this, and if you want to do it, I'm going to fight for you and I'll win." And I said, "I don't even need to read it. I know I want it." But he did read it that night and read it again on the airplane on the way back the next day, way back to Alabama. And I, of course, had no idea that it would have any resonance, because you just don't. You can't think outside of just the work you have to do. You can't see anybody, at least I never have, in my head, see anybody in the theater looking at it or what a finished product is. To me, the work is only about those days, doing those scenes, those pages, this text, and that's all I ever see.
You're an actress who was originally typecast, but I think now if anyone thought of an adjective for you, it would be versatile. You can do so many different things. I'm just thinking about the two most recent movies I've seen you in, My Name is Doris, and Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And they're my Lincoln, you had to struggle to get that part, mm-hmm. even though you were friendly, good mm-hmm. graces of Steven mm-hmm. Spielberg mm-hmm. and that Daniel Day-Lewis was interested in you for the part. What did it feel like at that point in your career? You're an Oscar winner, mm-hmm. you're an Emmy winner, and mm-hmm. here I am fighting for this role.
It felt like just as it should be. Just as it should be. It's odd. Every really important work experience, I mean, I guess there's been a few that were important that I didn't have to struggle like that, but not really. The ones that meant the most to me, I had to really lay myself on the line. And I don't know. In some ways, I think it made the work better.
Why?
Because it unearthed something in me that's much more valuable than ego. You know, that's much more valuable than any kind of comfortable position in the business or anything. It unearths some deep longing for the work that's just bigger than how many years you've been doing it. It's bigger than that. And all of that, you know, the working for Lincoln was just as it should be. It was just as it should be.
And My Name Is Doris, I think, speaks to an issue you probably face as an actress, is that she's an older woman who has a longing to be seen mm-hmm. and to be seen as sexual and attractive mm-hmm. to this young man, whether it's in her head or not.
It's totally in her head.
It's yeah. in her head. But she just wants it. She mm-hmm. needs it.
Yeah.
And for actresses and for newscasters, once you get past a certain age, the opportunities aren't there to mm-hmm. be seen mm-hmm. and to be heard. What are you doing to fight that?
Oh, nothing.
Nothing. Just being good at your job?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. Seen as a person, you know, as a human being on the planet is slightly different, I think, than the context of seeing yourself as a sexually viable person attracted to that person across the room and, hey, honey, what are you doing tonight? I'd much rather just be a productive, you know, seen human being on the planet. I find that arena, the arena that Doris was willing to go to, a much more, you know, difficult problem.
Kind of cringy.
Well, it just, I was just never good at it, hmm. honestly. I was never good at it. I don't get it. Obviously, I'll never get it. It just is. It just seems like a foreign language to me, and a language that, you know, you can't go to Berlitz and learn. I just don't get it.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you two questions. They're personal questions, but you're very open in this book. The first is about Burt Reynolds, who passed away a few weeks
yes.
ago. What is something that people don't know about him that you'd like them to know about him?
Hmm. Boy, oh boy, that is a very good question. No wonder you have your own show. Well, I think everybody knows so much about him. I was going to say how deeply devoted he was to his parents, I don't know. He was well read. He was I can't think of a thing that everybody doesn't already know.
Did he have
and
a nickname?
He hasn't said, you know, himself.
Did he have a nickname for you?
Did he have a what?
A nickname for you when you were together.
Oh, yes. Well, we know he but it wasn't a real nickname. He called me this in the film, and then sometimes he would do it, which was Frog. But he didn't really use it in real life. You know, once all of that was, you know, the doors were closed, I was just me and, you know, usually cooking dinner. And
just sounds normal.
Just normal, yeah.
And the last thing is you might get the Mom of the Year Award for on Twitter setting up your son.
Oh, my gosh.
With Olympic skater Adam Rippon. What made you go ahead and do that?
I have been banned from, obviously, seriously. I, as Sam says, I really do not understand the magnitude of social media. So it's like saying, from now on, I just want you to run everything by me before you push that button. And it turned out great because they actually met and are friends, and that's really nice. But he kind of was like, I'll fix this. It'll be fine. I was sort of mortified that it turned into what it did.
Mom, give me your smartphone.
And he said, he said, I need you to now run everything by me. So I, you know, oh, okay. So, I, you know, social media is, I look at it and I'm on it. But it, honestly, it's kind of a, I'm just never going to be really involved in it, mm-hmm. because it really scares me. And it, I just wonder what we're doing with all of this. I wonder if we're not just, you know, it's too easy breezy. And people are, certainly some people especially, you know, are not really rethinking before they push that send button.
That send button. Sally Field, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. On today's show, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite conversations with guests who've written memoirs. Our next conversation is with the writer and director Jill Soloway, who created the critically acclaimed Amazon series Transparent. Jill's memoir, She Wants It, Desire, Power, and Toppling the Patriarchy, was published by Crown Archetype last month. Let's take a listen. Were you writing this in real time, like keeping a diary or a journal about how you were feeling, or did you decide to write this after you'd come to your conclusion about how you wanted to live the rest of your life?
No, I started writing it about 4 years ago. So, in fact, when I sold the book, I was identified as straight. I was married, hetero, even femme-presenting, you know, just kind of regular American mom. And, yeah. So I sold the book as kind of like a classic tale of a woman trying to have it all, family and business.
And then yeah. when did you look at your first draft and say, this no longer applies?
Yeah, well, then I was able to use the writing of the book as a way to almost like have like a flashlight on my head as I was spelunking through the why am I like this? Mm-hmm. Trying to go through my past. I already had to go through my past with Transparent to look at, you know, what happens once a parent comes out as trans, when you look back at everything that happened when you were kids before your parent had come out. What was that life? What was that secrecy? Where were those hiding spaces? How did the secrets stand in for the boundaries? That was really the theme that I realized Transparent was about, that people keep secrets instead of having boundaries. So, yeah, I kind of needed the book because it was a different way of thinking and creating from writing dialogue and casting it. It was almost like my exterior was being taken care of with Transparent, where I could write these scenes and have these actors act them out. But my interior, where I was forcing myself to look at the choices I'd made throughout my life, was what was powering the writing of the book.
Now, that's interesting. When people decide, when they talk to people about pronouns, they say, do you prefer this pronoun? Or they say, do you use this pronoun? Is it important that there's a distinction there? Or do you think that it matters?
I mean, it's all so new. Yeah. It's amazing that we're even having this conversation. I mean, this is a conversation that 3 years ago, I don't think either one of us could have ever imagined. And yet it's so normal-ish that we're tossing around this notion that we might be able to have this conversation using the they pronoun to refer to me. And so I think, like, do you use this pronoun? Is it preferred? Like, it's all fine. Like, anything that is helping us to get to a place where we can use this pronoun that says, I don't see either male or female when I see you, which is such a huge ask.
It's a big leap for a lot of people.
It's a big leap. It's like male on the driver's license, female on the driver's license, and now you can get an X on your driver's license. And to me, this is such a giant philosophical shift in how we just group ourselves, how we think of ourselves, that whatever we need to do to make this happen, I use these pronouns, I prefer these, you know, whatever. Like, I'm so loose with it. I tell people she and her is fine. They and them is like frosting.
It's interesting, you know, as you talk about how we're struggling with this, I think about our kids, because we have kids about the same age, and my kid came home from school, and every paper he has now says his name and then preferred pronoun on the top of the paper. And
I thought, amazing.
You know, he's never going to, it's for him, this is just going to be part of his life, and there's someone in his class who a couple weeks changed the pronoun.
Fantastic.
And it's and he's just sort of like, okay, can you play kickball? Like, it doesn't, it's not really phasing him, and I'm sort of, I'm thinking to myself, well, that's how the change is going to happen. It's through the children.
Yeah. Yeah, born in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
The title, though, we have She Wants It.
Right.
And that can, you know, be as a pejorative, like, eh, she wants it, or it can be, you know, the Tiffany Haddish, like, she ready, she wants
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Who's the she?
Yeah, well, it's the person, it's exactly that question that made me want to keep this title, is, you know, who's the she? And it's really who's saying she. Because I think if two men are saying, oh, she wants it, it is pejorative. It's turning her into an object. And if two women are saying about another woman, they're complimenting her. So what an odd thing that the same words would be construed as an utter dangerous insult when said by two men. And a real like celebration of power when said by women. So she's a lot of people. She is who I used to be. She is the idea of the, you know, unnamed, you know, in terms of the she wants it, it's sort of, you know, I talk a lot in my book about the divided feminine and how men have different uses for two different kinds of women. If a woman is admired or adored, if she is their wife, mother, daughter, she gets a certain kind of treatment in their minds and in real life. And then there's this degraded half of the divided feminine, the so-called sluts, the hookers, the passed out women, the women who get no respect, the women who aren't believed. Men have this divide and women have to choose. And you're on the correct side of the divide if you're part of a man's financial life. Whisper, property, you know, wife, child. But somehow if you're not part of that man's identity, you're over here in this other place and you're in danger. And the more femme you are and the more female you are, you're more in danger of not being trusted. And the more you reveal your desire and say, oh, yeah, I wanted it. Wait, what did you want? Is this woman saying I wanted sex when she says I wanted it? Is her outfit showing or revealing that she had desire? She's in danger. And that's really the divided feminine in patriarchy. So that's the she. That degraded half of the divided feminine, that's the she that I'm concerned with, that I'm hoping to bring story to with the book.
One of the passages I really enjoyed in the book, and maybe just because it hit home as a working mom, is your description of the way fathers are perceived and the way mothers are perceived as not just a parent, but how the gender plays into it, whether you're good or bad. Would you read this paragraph? This
yes.
I read this and I was like, who can I call and read this to?
Yeah, this is a funny one, right? This cracks me up. Yeah, this is sort of like as I started to understand how I saw myself and other people saw me as in different genders. I am the best father in the world. I'm far better as a father than I am as a mother. Imagine a dad like this. Every day at 6 p.m., I get home from my really high-powered job where I make plenty of money for everybody. I have taken care of dinner by checking in with the sitter on the phone at around 3 and saying, yes, yes, turkey meatballs will be perfect. Thank you. Maybe we should have some broccoli just to be safe. And then when I get home, dinner is on the table and I thank the sitter and I dismiss her and I sit with my children and I hold space for questions about their day. After dinner, I spend time with them, make sure they have their bath, and I put them to bed. If you imagined a man doing the things I just described, you would think of him as an exceptionally emotionally connected and gentle man, a veritable master of the universe, doing everything at home and at work. But now look at me as a mother. I didn't pick my kids up after school. I didn't actually cook the dinner. We didn't do crafts, sports, or homework together. I wasn't a school volunteer. I couldn't comb their hair without making them cry. I wasn't warm and yummy and soft and cozy. I didn't rock them in my arms. I didn't make breakfast. I got no housework done. I didn't get to the gym. I didn't do that thing they tell women to do, to have sex whether or not you want to keep the marriage going. If I were a man, I'd be in the top 1% of all fathers. As a mother, I was a complete and total failure.
And you did smile.
Yeah, smile. Why are you smiling?
We're speaking with Jill Soloway about her new book, She Wants It, Desire, Power, and Toppling the Patriarchy. So the first chapter of your book is called Are You Sitting Down? And you recall a phone call from your dad when he revealed himself to be trans. And then you had to hold the secret for a little bit. He hadn't told anyone else yet. What was it like in that time when you had that information and no one else did?
Yeah, and I also just want to mention, because there's some social media feedback going on. So you're gendering my father as my father, and you're using the word he, because in the beginning of the book, I use the word father and I use the word he, even though now when we would speak about my parent, we would say parent instead of father, and we would say she.
Carrie.
Yes. And it's a really sensitive time for somebody like me who identifies as trans, who wants to go back and write about a part of my life when a trans person identified as male. And I just want to make sure that we mentioned that we are currently misgendering Carrie when we have this conversation, if we're using the word father or he. So it's a difficult thing when different people have different experiences of certain people and want to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. It's a real confusing thing for me to ask, how do I tell the story of what it felt like to have somebody come out to me who I thought was a man without misgendering them? So
story, though. You tell your story.
It's complex. But so remind me what the question was.
When you had this information,
oh, yeah,
and you were asked not to say anything just yet, what it was like to hold on to that information.
Well, I mean, my sister and I are sort of incredibly close, and we sort of share a mind. So it was really like I couldn't hold on to it until my sister knew. And I was just waiting and waiting and waiting for my parent to call my sister so that my sister and I could talk and say, what's going on? So yeah, I was kind of just texting my sister and saying, call dad, call dad, call dad, call dad. So
now that you think about that time, having had the experience you've had in the past few years, do you understand something better about it? About that, the time that your parent was going through?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think I'm so, so, so lucky that as a parent, I was able to make these incremental steps with myself where there wasn't the big coming out of the closet reveal. You know, I even think about when Caitlyn Jenner was on, I think, the Diane Sawyer show.
Yeah.
And she was in some ways like, you know, saying goodbye as her previous self and like coming out as a new self in this like very crisp corner, like old me, new me. I think a lot of that is due to transphobia and trans misogyny, you know, where it's like, we don't want to see the in-between. We just want to see you when you look like a perfect, beautiful, camera-ready woman. The in-betweens are messy, the on-the-ways, the non-binaries, the word trans means bridge. And I think people first were really comfortable with saying this person went from male to female or female to male. But a lot of people sort of stay on the bridge or want to be seen on the bridge. And I think it's messy for such a binary society. So I've been lucky enough to just move very, 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 very slowly. It's like, cut my hair a little more, a little less makeup. Oh, wow, I like the way men's underwear feels instead of women's. You know what? Shopping in the men's department kind of feels good. Okay, wow, I'm getting gendered as male out in the world. People are saying, sir. Hey, that's kind of fun. You know, people come up to a table and go, ladies, may I take your order? And I think, who the F are they talking to? You know, how do you see the word lady when you see me? So it's been totally incremental with me. I think with my parent, because of the way they were raised in a society that's completely transphobic and completely misogynistic, particularly for people who were assigned male at birth, claiming a trans identity is so hard. Julia Serrano is an amazing trans philosopher, and she said a couple of things about where transphobia and trans misogyny comes from. Because you may see somebody who was assigned female at birth, and they're clearly assigned female at birth, and they're wearing a man's suit, and you wouldn't even look. And if you see somebody who's assigned male at birth and they're wearing a dress, you go, oh my God, what am I looking at? And Julia Serrano, her idea was that there is so much misogyny in this world that we assume that if anybody would choose, quote unquote, choose to give up their male privilege, they must be crazy.
When you were writing the show, Transparent, and you mentioned just on Twitter how there are people who are having issues with the use of the language and the choice to use what word when and what pronoun when. You wrote it. It came from a good place. It came from your heart. It came from your experience. When you looked back, Do you see some of the mistakes you made?
Yes, totally.
And what's an example?
Well, casting a cis man as a trans woman was so hurtful to trans women and such a problem. You know, representation is an issue just for any group that says we need more to see of ourselves. So if you had a person who was white who was playing somebody who was Asian, you know, that would be incredibly offensive, full stop. But for trans women who are in the midst of being accused of being men dressing up, the problem of having a man play a trans woman that actually involves dressing up, because we're on a TV show, is a really dangerous conception for things like the public safety of trans women in bathrooms. So not only were we not allowing trans women to represent themselves, we were also continuing a stereotype that was and is incredibly life-threatening. So I just have to go on the record constantly and apologize to the trans community and ask for forgiveness for having to have had my education in public.
When you think about your experience, you'd written a memoir in 2005, right? Tiny Ladies in Shiny Pants.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this because I read Roxane Gay's books out of order. I read Hunger first and then Bad Feminist. And doing that, I thought about all the pain that was in Hunger that's not in Bad Feminist, because she's really sort of decided to embrace all the difficulty and her sexual assault. And in Bad Feminist, she just kind of seems like, I'm a free spirit, I'm out there. Are there things from that first memoir that who you are now is hidden in there and you didn't see it, or?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a lot of things in there that are me trying to figure this stuff out. You know, I talk in this book about what it was like to go through puberty really late, like at the age of 17, and really suddenly have the kind of body that made men think they wanted to see what it looked like naked. That was a really overwhelming and fast and brutal shift for me, where I went from being a person with thoughts and a mind to attempting to navigate what men wanted from me. And I think because I was a curious person and an ambitious person, I didn't experience it as trauma. I was like, oh, this body is an all-access pass to new experiences. I can get into any room I want to get into. So I'm going because I want to see. I want to see what it's like to meet famous guys. I want to see what happens when I go through this door.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think I was putting myself in experiences where I was re-experiencing myself as an object over and over again, attempting to have subjectivity out of it by pretending like I was consenting to all of it, when in fact I wasn't tuned into my body whatsoever. I didn't know what I wanted. I was letting or allowing things to happen that I wasn't sure if I wanted them to happen. And I think that's it's kind of a tragedy.
I have to ask about the toppling the patriarchy, because that is what you yelled during one of your acceptance speeches. And I wish I could say that I came up with this question, but I didn't. My producer, Rosie, did. She said, how would you explain to an auditorium of kindergartners what the toppling the patriarchy means?
Well, patriarchy is men mostly protecting men, mostly protecting male power. So it's men protecting male power. So to kindergartners, I would say the patriarchy is, you know, you look around at the pictures of all of the presidents, you know, around your classroom, and it's like, guy, 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 wait, man, man, man. They're all men. Topping the patriarchy would be that how many presidents are there? 100? We're going to have 100 women first. We're going to have 100 queer people first, and then we'll get back to men. That we need to start to create equality and equity in leadership. And the dream of taking power and handing it to people who are not white cis men is a dream about peace and love and tolerance. Maybe even the end of war. That's what I would say to kindergartners.
I think they'd like that. As your book came out, there was news about this being the final season of Transparent on Amazon, and that the final season is going to be a movie musical.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little bit of Yentl.
A little bit of Jesus Christ Superstar. It's going to be some singing, some dancing, some choreography.
Is Maura Pfefferman going to be represented in some way now that Jeffrey Tambor
is that
left?
A spoiler? I feel like that's a spoiler. I just want to let people come see it, because there's such a juicy way that we're handling that question that I don't want to give it away.
What do you hope people take away from your book?
I like when people read books with a pen in their hand or a highlighter and they fold in pages. And they, you know, for me, when I read certain writers like Maggie Nelson or Masha Gessen, Eileen Miles, like these amazing thinkers, these people who blow my mind, and I get my pen out when I'm reading and I just dog ear pages and I think, like what you had, you know, I want to share this with a friend. I hope people have that visceral, tactile experience of feeling like they're getting a letter from a best friend and that they're feeling seen.
Jill, thank you so much for coming to the studio. This is All of It. We'll be right back.